Welcome to New Legacy Radio with Christine Erickson. Our weekly programming serves the growing global community of people without children. We also inform practitioners and institutions who influence policy, organizational culture, and media narratives about issues of concern to our community. Now, on to our show.
Welcome to the show, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Christine Erickson, and the founder of New Legacy Institute. New Legacy Institute is the only policy institute focused on the global culture and impact of pronatalism. Today, we are going to be discussing what the many ways women are impacted through pronatalism matched with misogyny and the blame game around population crises, in quotes. I put crises in quotes. And joining us today is our wonderful guest, Ruby Warrington, who has not only written several books, but her new book, Women Without Kids, is being published today. It is out and available for you. So if you have not seen it, if you've not ordered it, please do that. I am happy to support, to recommend this brilliant book. And thank you so much, Ruby, for being here with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's really good to be here. Yeah, I'm really happy to be connected to you.
Thank you, Ruby. And I just want to share a few words with our listeners about you, just a quick bio for those who don't know who you are. Ruby is a British-born author, editor, podcaster, and the founder of Numinous Books. Recognized as a true thought leader, Ruby has the unique ability to identify issues that are destined to become part of the cultural narrative. That is an understatement. her previous books include Material Girl, Mystical World, Sober Curious, and The Sober Curious Reset. Her work has been featured by countless media outlets globally, including The New York Times, The Guardian, and Good Morning America. So thank you again for being with us here on New Legacy Radio today, Ruby. I'm so honored to have you here and to discuss some of these profound issues that not only you have addressed in such a complete, integral, and compassionate, empathetic way in your writing, but the timeliness of everything. Mm. Like I always say, well, when isn't there a good time to address pronatalism? You know, the beginning of time until now, right? Which is so silly because there's always something. But I do think that the perspectives and the even understanding of what pronatalism is, like I feel like we're just scratching the surface. And yet it's this framework that has permeated everything that we do in the world, systems and structures and policies and our everyday lives and decisions. So thank you for this gift of your writing and for, again, approaching it the way that you have.
Well, yeah, timely is interesting. That's been a word that has followed me around my career ever since I started out doing lifestyle sort of magazine and newspaper journalism in the UK in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, and was always just very attuned for whatever reason to kind of social trends and cultural trends. And I've sort of parlayed that into my career as an author. It's tricky as an author though, because I started work on this book at the end of 2019, knowing that it wouldn't be out for, 3 years realistically. And so not really knowing where the conversation would be in terms of women without kids and everything that, kind of lives alongside that or is part of that subject. That's a very broad umbrella sort of title for everything that I discuss in the book. but yeah, here we are. Mm-hmm. Here we are, less than a year out from the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the documentary Birth Gap sort of being picked up by all sorts of cultural commentators, Elon Musk scaremongering about population collapse, et cetera, et cetera. And it does just feel like this conversation is, the volume is getting dialed up on what it means to be a woman without kids, and again, that's a very broad umbrella kind of term for everything that I talk about in the book. But yeah, I'm really happy to be here and to have discovered your work, because as I discovered in writing this book, there's so much more to this subject than the personal kind of individual choices and decisions that we're making around our procreative potential. There's the personal, But this subject is universal. And talk about, you know, subjects that are destined to be part of the cultural narrative. I truly believe that this subject, shifting attitudes to family formation, is going to be one of the number one most important things that we need to have adult, mature, progressive conversations about in this century. It's really at the heart of our humanity, and it's at the heart of where we're headed as a human race. Not to get too grandiose, yes. But I'm sort of feeling quite pumped up about it.
Absolutely. Stay pumped. I appreciate it. What you said about, you know, moving from the personal is really why we started looking at policy and created the Institute, because it's a stretch. You know, we've been very isolated and visible in many ways, and yet targeted and demonized, if you will, for lack of a better word, at the same time. And how do we shift this? You know, what is our response to media like Birth Gap? What is our collective response? And that's one of the things I also appreciate, even in the title of your book, but speaking, while we have we come from different choices or spectrums of choices, really, on this journey. You know, I can, I think, were you writing about yourself, or was it a quote about being four years old or 3.5? I think it was you declaring that you would never have children. And I just shared that with somebody the other day. I'm like, oh, I've done this grieving, you know, went through this childless space in my life, but I made declarations at 4 and 30 and, you know, in my teenage years about things, and then got married. And all of a sudden I had these different, all of a sudden this other person took over, you know, and it's like all the cellular knowing and examples I had from growing up crept in, and I started thinking about things differently or feeling about them, you know. And I think, oh my gosh, this is not a straight road, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's not. And I think, what you're sort of touching on, and I think the personal is always universal, because all of our personal decisions, choices, beliefs, the way we think about things, the way we see things, the way we experience the world, all of this is a product of the environment that we're being influenced by. As well as, I mean, I came up very quickly a sort of butted up against this question of nature over nurture multiple times whilst writing the book, just thinking about why are we making the choices we are? How many of our choices are truly autonomous, and how many of our choices are influenced in conscious and unconscious ways by the environment that we're being raised in and the messaging and the conditioning that we're absorbing? And I think, that's just a really interesting sort of subject or lens to view what is this, you know, steep and steady decline in the birth rate globally. That's kind of where I came to that. I came to the project of writing this book from really wanting to understand on a deep level and make my own peace once and for all with never having wanted to be a mom. For me, it wasn't about making peace with not being able to have children. For me, it was making peace with feeling like, God, there's just something, there has to be something wrong with me. But my failure to want to be a mother had felt very shameful and very, it was a challenging position to hold, because it just felt so odd. And so I wanted to make peace with that. But then in looking at what are all of the sort of deeper and more subconscious sort of influences that have made me a woman without kids, of course, I had to look at all of the cultural, social, political, environmental, economic factors that are influencing all of our lives and ultimately driving this drop off in the birth rate, which is why I frame this as sort of part of our evolution. It's part of the evolution of womankind, you know?
Absolutely. I love that. And I was looking for this quote I pulled up where you talked about, you know, nature versus nurture, or you quoted somebody, Jillian Ragsdale. And I love this in terms of thinking about policy and framing so much. The quote is, Jillian Ragsdale, what she had to say about feeling, quote unquote, the feeling rules attached to motherhood. Quote, once you have to make rules about something in society, it's a clue that the thing you're trying to stop is natural. All these cultural rules that say women should be married, should have children, you wouldn't need that pressure if women were likely to make other choices if they had the freedom.
Right.
I just think that sums up so much.
So for a bit of context, Gillian Ragsdale's an evolutionary biologist. And I was originally introduced to her work. I heard her on a Radio 4 program, BBC Radio 4 program, about the rise in childlessness. And she uttered this statement, and I just thought, I have to talk to this woman. She said, there is no such thing as a biological maternal instinct. What human beings need to have for our evolutionary trajectory is a sex drive. There is no biological desire for that sexual activity to lead to the birth of a child. The sex is the thing that we have to want. And ideally, in terms of the continuation of the species, if we have enough sex and we have enough sex of a procreation, where procreation can occur, then eventually some babies will come. And then she said, and at that point, it does help if there is a biological or natural desire to look after these young humans who need our protection and our nurturance and our guidance, but that is not necessarily that's not due to a person's biological sex. The nurturing instinct can apply and be triggered in men and women. Anybody, in fact, who becomes the primary caregiver for an infant, there will be brain changes that kind of trigger a nurturing protective instinct in an ideal world. But yeah, in terms of the baby fever, which I had never experienced and felt honestly like there must be something, I must be missing something hormonally, maybe there's an imbalance or something. That baby fever, she suggests, is much more of a cultural and social construct.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that. And thank you for sharing all of that context. I appreciate it. And I know our listeners will really love to hear that full scope of that. So thank you. Mm. I think it is so important to, you know, as you have done, peel these layers away in all these domains of our life and our society. And I think that there are such few places where we are doing that well. And you talk about, you know, the sex drive and then procreation and if that instinct kicks in. And I think so much of pronatalist policy, economic structures, all of that we're seeing the backlash toward as we're not fitting the demographics. We don't fit those models, right? If we ever did, we certainly do not now. And it's, you know, that assumption of what happens after children are here. And that side of it, from the time they arrive forward, is where, as a society, or particularly I speak to American society, but also on a global scale, you know, in different ways, that's where we are failing human beings.
Totally.
And so to just be looking at policy or economic drivers or creating people as workers, I mean, it's taken the self, the soul out of humanity to look at things in terms of a quote unquote population collapse and the fear mongering and the predatory nature of this by weaponizing, for example, in Birth Gap by Stephen Shaw, the childlessness itself. First by not even understanding the definition of childlessness within the context of the community who lives that, and using that as a broad brush terminology, but then also sort of preying on that side of the experience of not becoming a mother and the emotional space of that. And if we just fixed things, all these babies would come.
Right. Right. Exactly. No. It's so minimizing of our actual lived experience as human beings, let alone as parents.
Right.
Childless or child-free people. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point about when I hear people talking about population collapse, they're talking about economic collapse. They're talking about the collapse of an economic system which relies on a fresh, steady supply of cheap and readily available human labor power. Mm. And in the case of Elon Musk, let's just call him out on this. I mean, he's one of the people who is plowing billions of dollars, which could be put into, I don't know, healthcare, childcare, the kind of things that might actually help people raise children, healthy, happy children, to become healthy, happy adults. He's one of the people who is plowing billions of dollars into AI technologies, which are designed to replace the need of humans, therefore keeping the cost of production down and ensuring that people like himself, the captains of industry, continue to reap enormous profits from said human and unhuman labor. And I just, the hypocrisy in all of it is
exactly.
just astonishing, astonishing. The fact that more people aren't calling this out.
The both sides of the mouth, so to speak. I don't even have words sometimes when I think but, that's why I'm glad we have writers like you. Really looking in that direction, then espousing this, you know, population collapse and we need more workers at the same time. To me, it's I don't know if it's the extremeness of these things that you know, in watching at least the first part of Birth Gap, for example, you know, when anyone presents a strong idea, charismatic or not, and people are like, oh yeah, I didn't think of that. Oh yeah, you're right. This is a massive problem. Oh, there are holes. There are holes in your map where people are supposed to be arriving. You know, I think, oh wow, that kind of influence, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much.
It takes confidence and a platform.
Yes.
And the confidence and a platform.
Yes.
And I'm just, you know, I don't want to get too reductive or binary about this, but middle-aged white men are very good at confidently taking the stage and making statements that people then kind of buy into. For people who haven't seen the documentary, the demographer, Stephen Shaw, who made it, he created these sort of maps where it literally looks about as if the country's being eaten away as not enough new people are being born. And it leaves these horrible sort of, I don't know, just really nasty sci-fi kind of dark black splodges. And everyone he shows these maps to is sort of horrified, just like, oh my God, this is awful. What we forget is that those dark spots in the map are filled with elder people who are still members of society, who still have valuable things to offer, but who are not seen as valuable to, again, the captains of industry, because they're no longer productive. They're no longer creating wealth for the owning classes. These are people who, like small children, need investment, who need care, who are dependent in some way, and often not actually. You know, we've spent so much in terms of investment, human ingenuity, et cetera, over the past century, in particular, extending human lifespans. And yet still people are seen as just, people are just written off after the age of 60, 65. And it's just, we need a huge adjustment in terms of how we view and value our elder populations, rather than just as soon as somebody is no longer contributing in an active way to the workforce, to the labor force, and to the economy, seeing them as just this empty black spot in the map.
Yes.
You know, it's not that the the population isn't disappearing. It's just no longer economically productive for the people who are benefiting and reaping profits from people's labor power. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, the extreme and overt.
I don't know why I apologize.
I apologize.
Would Elon Musk apologize?
Take it back. Yes.
Taking back that apology. I'm confidently claiming this platform to make this case.
Yes. The not valuing any demographic, right? And the overvaluing of other demographics. The irony too in, or the conflict of, you know, things that we have progressed in, quote unquote, because I don't know if they're all progressive or not, but, you know, in terms of, let's say, medical achievements, for example, health-wise, we are always striving to live longer, basically, right? Isn't that why we're supposed to do things better and you know, exercise and all of these things, right? So we're going for a longevity of life, but you get dumped off once you reach a certain age. And so even the conflict of what our economy is and what our sciences are going toward or our academics are in conflict with each other.
Exactly.
And it is so curious, like in my mind, I keep calling it missing math. You know, the statistics from the baby boom forward and watching these demographics, we have demographers, we have statisticians, we have environmentalists, we have academics, we have, you know, name it, from the spaces of knowledge, of monitoring. And yet it's like, oh, we didn't see this coming. You didn't?
Right.
And the question of,
let's implement a one child policy and then freak out 30 years down the line when we don't have enough people.
We're going to have enough people to
continue to maintain the growth that we have, that our economy relies on.
Yes. And the false exponential growth model that we have pushed and pushed and pushed to the nth degree, that is reflected both in the state of the environment, the mental health of people, the lack of well-being in lifestyles, in workspaces. It has reached, I think it reached it a long time ago, but I think it's over the edge. All of these assessments, particularly during and post-COVID, well, it's not even post-COVID, but due to COVID, the different assessments about the workplace and things that changed or things that people started, you know, reclaiming. Or I always put it in a consent framework. People want, they want to work where they have given their consent to work or to lead, you know, not, and capitalism sort of requires an absence of that, you know, what we're talking about at that level. And I just think, so what did you see coming? And that's what my question is. What did you see coming? And this question that is explored of, we don't know how it happened. And in country after country, men are having this analysis and this conversation, and in the section of Birth Gap that I got to, and it doesn't have to be even in that. It's in articles, it's in headlines, it's in the media every day. And I think, what did you see? What were you looking at? You know, your graphs that are just linear, women are just linear. Well, they did this then. Why would they be doing anything different? Like, and talk about the trap of and lack of human acknowledgement of women in all of this.
Exactly. And again, for people who haven't seen Birth Gap, a little bit of explanation. And I don't I don't want to, like, you know, badmouth this film, but it did make me quite angry. And I could see that on some levels, the filmmaker was coming from a very genuine place of just wanting to get to the bottom of this. But there he is, scratching his head again, speaking to all of these men, middle-aged men. So it happened in the 70s. What happened in the 70s? I mean, it just, what was going on in the 70s? The women's liberation movement. Yes, you might have heard about this. Yeah. The movement globally that gave women finally a modicum of autonomy over how we live our lives, who we partner up with, how we earn our money, how we support ourselves, how we educate ourselves. That's what happened in the 1970s. And that is one of the reasons why we're seeing a drop off in the birth rate. To return to birth rates that we saw prior 1970s, we'd have to roll back all of women's all of the autonomy and freedom that has been won for women in the women's liberation movement. It requires that level of child, that level of a birth rate requires women to not have the say that we have fought hard for over how we live our lives.
Absolutely. And that is what we are speaking to now. I mean, that is why we have a need for this collective action. This is why we're talking about policy. It's not because policy is the answer. It's because it's what we have right now. You know, right. It's also part of that, the systems that aren't working or aren't acknowledging what is. And I just think, gosh, if you made a decision today in your life based on something that you did in 1970, let's say, you know, if that's how you were assessing, like 35 years later, I'm going to make this decision based on that, not what anything to do with your current circumstances. This is the other part that is missing. It's like, but there are demographics today. First of all, it is not shocking. It is only shocking up against the push for these systems to continue in the ways they haven't been working for a very long time. Hence the women's movement. You know, they haven't been working for all humans. Right. And it's ever. The denial. Yeah, ever. The denial of that is so deep, and it is extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. It is extremely dangerous.
And so I'm not a demographer. I'm not a politician. I'm not a policy maker. As a culture maker and a conversation starter, I think that having conversations like this and bringing to consciousness what we're up against and what needs to be discussed is where I see my work in this movement and what I hope this book will help to do.
Absolutely. I believe it will. Thank you again, Ruby. And the book, Women Without Kids, is out today. We are going to take a short pause. And when we return, we will have more with Ruby Warrington. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back.
Follow Voice America at facebook.com/Voice America for juicy updates from your favorite radio shows and podcasts.
New Legacy Institute is committed to equitable and inclusive change to recognize the millions of people without children. We invite you to learn more about the Institute at newlegacyinstitute.com. Join us in creating meaningful and actionable change for our community today.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
New Legacy Radio is a social justice platform for people without children. Our weekly show airs globally and is supported by listeners and readers like you. Your contributions and sponsorship are a unique opportunity to support your community and for our allies, businesses, and organizations to recognize and include people without children. To make your contribution, please go to sponsornlr.com. We thank you for tuning in and look forward to sharing our platform with you.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
This is New Legacy Radio with Christine Erickson. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everyone. We are speaking with our guest today, Ruby Warrington, author of Women Without Kids. And I should actually say the whole title. I'm sorry I haven't, because it's such a lovely title. And I just think, I keep going to that. Women Without Kids where is it? The Revolutionary Rise of an Unsung Sisterhood. And I wanted to bring this up now. I mean, I should have said the whole title at the beginning, but I know that you can Google Women Without Kids and find the book and find your work. What I love about that title, let alone your writing, is this unsung sisterhood. I think so much of looking at what pronatalism is from all of the perspectives of, you know, the economy, politics, our everyday lives, our choices, the ways that this has permeated our everyday lives and our long-term lives, how we are seen as a demographic. All of the things that you address, looking at it as a sisterhood, and not that that hasn't been said before, but a collective, you know, and as I just shared with you, the Institute as well, you know, part of my drive was how do we harness our collective power or create it, you know, let alone among all women. And what is so beautiful in your book is the way that you address and have this just incredible empathy for the whole range of how people have become mothers and not, you know, this is about all of us. This impacts all of us. And if people are parenting, of course it impacts how they're parenting, you know, what is next for their children, all of those things. And so without, going on and on, I would love to hear from you about that. That's the general overlay. But thank you for the way that you expressed those same things so beautifully and in such a detailed and insightful way.
Yeah, the subhead, I kind of broke it down. I was speaking to my publisher yesterday, actually, and we were talking about it. And so first of all, the revolutionary rise of an unsung sisterhood, the rise speaks to the fact that black and white terms, more and more people are choosing either to have far fewer children or less able to have as many children as they would like. And an increasingly significant minority are having no children at all for whatever reason. So there's the rise. Revolutionary, because as we were sort of touching on in the first half, us withdrawing from either withdrawing from reproductive duties or being unable to experiencing fertility issues or experiencing relationship issues or pressure on family life that are making us unable to have the children or the families that we'd like. Confidently claiming this path is revolutionary. Yes. It's just modeling that there's a different way to do this. Mm-hmm. And that it's time to really talk seriously about how we're going to restructure our societies to better cater to all human beings. Revolutionary. And then the unsung sisterhood. I'd always been aware of this sort of a false divide between, first of all, mothers and non-mothers. Mm-hmm. And then within the camp of non-mothers, the ones who can't have children and the ones who don't want children, being painted with a very different sort of strokes, I suppose, you know, people who can't have children, deserving of our sympathy, if not empathy. Always. And then people who don't want to have children, just ultimately being selfish, narcissistic, deluded, et cetera, layer on the pejoratives from there. But it struck me that no matter what our reasons for being women without kids, the net effect, the feelings of being othered, the feelings of being a failure, the feelings of there's something wrong with me, the feeling of I don't fit in, the feeling of my needs are not being taken into account, my experiences are not being listened to, are universal amongst women without kids. And so I wanted to focus more on what unites us versus what separates us, being these kind of like different reasons we might have. You know, I remember someone telling me when I first kind of said I or sort of mentioned in my own kind of community, you know, that I'd be writing on this subject just in a newsletter. I had quite an angry reply from somebody who had had a really hard time with IVF not working out. Oh, another privileged child-free person, you know, good for you. Good for you. Lucky for you that you never wanted to have children. And I do recognize it is a privilege in some ways to have not wanted to have a child, a much easier path in some ways than to desperately want to have a child and for not to be able to. And so I recognize and acknowledge that in the book and in my own deeper kind of investigations into my own reasons for not wanting to have a child. I recognized in the way that we sometimes only can in our adulthood, having got some perspective on our earliest years, that my experience of family was not one that I ever wanted to replicate. And actually, I have experienced or acknowledged quite a lot of envy for people who grew up in a warm, loving, nurturing family, for whom family is the center of their life and who would long to replicate that because it provides them such warmth, security, support, and recognizing I never had that sense of warm security support in my family, which is not to say I had a particularly traumatic upbringing. There was just a particular tone of family dysfunction that meant I never felt family was never a cozy, warm place for me. Mm-hmm. And so it has always felt very natural to me to just sort of stake out my own kind of ground and do things on my own and be uber self-sufficient in a way. Mm-hmm. And so touching base with my pain, my, as Jodi Day terms it, the disenfranchised grief of not having had a family that I wanted to replicate, not having had a relationship with any of my grandparents because my parents were estranged from their parents, you know? Yeah. These are losses that I am now grieving. Yeah. Losses I didn't even realize were part of my story as a child-free person, you know? So touching base with that pain has given me so much more empathy for the pain that somebody who desperately wants to create a family for themselves might experience in their journey with infertility, for example. And I think those sorts of, that sort of bridge building has been a really important part of this book. Writing this book for me. And I think it is what will help to unite what I have called the unsung sisterhood of women without kids. I state in the introduction that the book is for anybody who identifies as a woman without kids for whatever reason. And I even speak to mothers who sometimes long to remember the women they are without their kids, who sometimes question, why is this not coming naturally to me? did I really choose this for myself? Who mm-hmm. sometimes maybe even wish they didn't have kids. And mm-hmm. I've had so many moms, early readers who are mothers, thank me for yeah. including them in this and for helping them to make peace or better understand some of their own conflicted feelings about parenthood, having already become parents. Mm-hmm. It's lovely to hear that reflection from you. It was I didn't know when I started writing this book if I'd be able to pull it off, because there have been such rigid divides between these different camps. And so it's gratifying to hear that you got the sense of sisterhood from the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate what you just said. And I think, even just listening to you, it opens me and makes me feel, I don't know, just stronger about moving in these directions of this collectiveness, not sameness, but look, we're all having these experiences driven by, similar social structures, systemic things, where we've made choices that we didn't even have the opportunity to become conscious about sometimes, and you look at things differently in different places in your life, or incidents will bring things up, but it's not like, you come from your family or whatever space you were raised in, and then there's like an undoing and reflection camp, like you're talking about earlier, coming out of that, or the next stage. It's once you start seeing things and you see the whole system, or you reflect on your decisions, it's like, oh, you see all the interconnection and you can't unsee it, and even having the opportunity to do that is a privilege in some way, to be able to look at those things and synthesize. And I think it's also a gift, in the way that you do that in your writing and speaking, because it's always what's been needed, but it's definitely what is needed now and next in reframing. Even frame is like the gross word. Shifting these ways of being and the systems that we're stuck in that you were talking about earlier, whether we feel stuck in them or not, it's worth a look, how did we come to this place and where are we going? And as women who are so conveniently and specifically targeted around population growth or rise, or, it's always what should we be doing with our bodies to meet these needs? And how do you turn that around? These sterile sort of environments that are assessing the very value human beings, particularly females, on what they can offer and not, to something that they may not be a direct part of or want to be.
I think that, we're really, we're at a moment in our human story, really, where we're being asked to revalue the meaning of any one human life, And I think the fewer humans we have, the more we will be asked to revalue each individual life. It used to be that women had 10, 15 kids because it was a given that a large number of them would probably die in infancy, and it was a given that many women would die in childbirth and many men would die on the battlefield. This was, life was cheaper in a way, because we hadn't progress to the point where we actually get to really truly value each unique and individual human life. And I think what we're witnessing now is a conflict between the old growth model and this new model of self-actualization that so much of sort of progress has been angling for, like to really kind of discover who we are as human beings, what we're here to create, like what we're here to offer, versus just being seen as cogs in a larger wheel, So yeah, it's a very interesting time philosophically, even, to be considering what does it mean to bring a new life into the world? What is the meaning of that life? What is the value of that life?
Yeah. And how do we, in valuing women without first qualifying them in relationship to who they are, what they do for someone else?
Right.
You know.
Yes. Yes. Totally. Exactly. And to go to speak a little to the title of this this episode, this blame game.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, it just feels so convenient to blame women for leaving it too late to have children, for selfishly focusing on their careers, for misguidedly putting their career and their financial stability ahead of settling down in a ideally heterosexual relationship. You know, it's just this blaming of women for whichever way you look at the kind of population's quote unquote crises is just, yeah, it just feels so lazy at best and regressive, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's something, that's where the revolutionary part comes in. Mm-hmm. The more women who can boldly take the platform and confidently state, this is why I'm not having children, whatever reason.
Right.
For that to be taken seriously, you know, for that to be respected.
Yeah.
And if those collective decisions to have fewer children shines a negative light on the way that mothers, women are expected to do their mothering, as that definitely does in the United States, where it seems like something as simple and basic as paid leave is impossible to get past the policymakers. I think that's what we're all tasked with. And that's what I'm calling our unsung sisterhood into.
Absolutely. And, you know, with this blame or the direction always going there, you know, watching things that are entirely, whether they're male-led or not, the questioning of women without the conversation of any other gender is just so, I don't know, it's like, it's hilarious. It's not hilarious in a haha way, but it's just so absurd to me. And then
Why are we not sitting boys down and teaching them how to be fathers?
Yeah.
You know, and the issue of absent fathers is a huge driver in people wanting to have less children if they're in a position to even control their, you know, their reproductive outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that, you know? As one of many,
men could be
invited into this conversation too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And you know, it's not even irony. I don't have words anymore. I'm going to think of some deeper words, some stronger words in my spare time. But it's like the way we are focused on, you would think we do have the power. Because we're controlling the population collapse, we're controlling, and yet it's the complete opposite. It is the control of women that this response requires to shift something. It is the fear that women are not controlled, economies are going to collapse, people are going to die, we won't have enough population, we won't have enough workers. Like, my gosh, we'll have to close schools, and then how will people teach? You know, I mean,
well, there won't be any children, so that's fine. We don't need schools. We just need to put all the money that's being put into schools into elder care housing.
Right. And I
how about that?
How did the shift not happen? You know, that, you know, you're talking about policy and really basic policy, for parents who have children, let alone child-centered policy, which is another thing we're going to look at in the future of the Institute. Child-centered policy, the well-being of children, you know, my gosh, how seldom is that the forefront of the conversation? You know, it's a default, because it does feel like they are looked at, the workers, the next taxpayer, that at least in this country, it's this thing. So, okay, set that aside. And what about all these parental rights and this and that, that do not serve the child, but in the name of the child, which is a whole nother issue. I'd love to go back to something you've written about and that you touched on a few minutes ago about self-sufficiency and the idea. I think, you know, when we look at policies, not only around having children or not, which is kind of the very basic, you know, denominator there, we look at, you know, diverse relationships, diverse family structures, women who are single or people who are single, and in the workplace, how, you know, workplace policies, economic policies, housing policies, COVID pandemic support policies, financial support, support as aging in solo or in different relationships that aren't legally protected. I mean, you could go on and on. None of this has been examined thoroughly, you know, I mean, except for, you know, significant changes being done by some really great organizations like the Chosen Family Law Center in New York, who has implemented and done incredible work to not only do contracting to support people in different scenarios, family scenarios, platonic or not. I mean, it's like, this is who people are. This is how we're choosing, all the ways we're choosing to live. And yet everything is still written in one direction. So from the perspective of the models and all the things that these captains of industry, as you say, are trying to hold so tightly on, and policymakers who are influenced by that, we have failed a long time ago.
Yes.
We didn't just rise today. We're continuing to rise, but we have always been here. And so that lack of acknowledgement from the beginning, and yet watching this demographic, they're shocked. I think the shock should come from not watching our demographic from the perspective of how we are not included in society. And yet then when you want to say, oh, we're driving the collapse of it, like, it's not funny. Okay, I'm not laughing to all our listeners. I'm just so absurd. I don't know where to go sometimes, you know?
It's the exploding head emoji kind of a situation.
All the time.
Well, I think what you're hinting at is that, like, there has been over the past 50 years more of a recognition of individuals who fall outside of the very traditional white, middle class, heteronormative nuclear family model, which essentially is what all policy caters to and what the economy is still ultimately built on, even though, you know, for a very long time and for many demographics of people, like, both parents have always had to work. That's if you even have two parents in the house. Like, there have always been people who've lived their lives in the margins around that model. And yet, as much as there has been more recognition of these people as valid members of society, which we all are, policy hasn't caught up or evolved or been tweaked to kind of, like, reflect the differing needs of people who are existing out of that very kind of rigid sort of patriarchal model. And I think we're just seeing system collapse as a result of that. It's like,
exactly.
This shift has always been occurring. This shift has been occurring for hundreds of years. And policy has rigidly refused to reflect the shift. And so what we're seeing now is policies that no longer work, systems that no longer work, and that will collapse if our, if we continue, if this shift continues to evolve, which it will.
And the, again, you know, to say irony is like lax, but of that is, when we look at policy, at least from the Institute perspective, or I look at policy, the way that we look at policy language, or even our own language within the Institute, and which is also why I appreciate the way you wrote, is this inclusiveness that does not only benefit our community, it actually benefits everyone in different ways. And I think that is just so notable, not only in our community, but other activist communities, the disability community, the LGBTQ plus community, you know. And I just think every time there's a change, the neurodivergent and diversity community, every time that is noted in the workplace or policy, it helps other people in some way. And I think, why is this being so fought? You know,
exactly.
Because equity is a threat.
Yes. Exactly. And ultimately, we're talking about recognizing the full spectrum of our humanity.
Yes.
And creating and writing policy that supports the full spectrum of our humanity. And that is very much on the table at this juncture in our evolution.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ruby. You can learn more about Ruby and her new book, on rubywarrington.com. Thank you for listening. Tune in again next week. And as always, we welcome this continued conversation on any of our platforms and to our community and beyond. May you always find the spaces where you're truly celebrated. Take good care. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to New Legacy Radio. We hope this show has given you thoughtful context and insight to better connect with our community. For more information about the Institute or to share your questions or comments, find us on any of our social media platforms or simply go to newlegacyinstitute.com. New Legacy Radio, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.